You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's pod is Daryl Davis, who has played with, get this, Muddy Waters' legendary blues band, Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley's Jordanaires, as well as his own Daryl Davis Band. And he has received numerous awards for both his music, but also his humanitarian work, as Daryl has spent his life doing race reconciliation work, which has been documented in his books, Clandestine Relationships and The Klan Whisperer, along with documentaries and features and a host of media. You've probably heard of him, and everything from the New York Times to CNN. You're really going to enjoy the podcast. Daryl Davis, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
In the prologue to your book, The Klan Whisperer, you write, quote, "Fear is instilled in us through ignorance, which breeds hate. We hate those things of which we are ignorant. Hatred, if not kept in check, will escalate to destruction," end quote. I don't think many people would actually disagree with that statement, but I do think that there's many people who would be confounded by your actions, which are inspired by those words. So tell us a little bit about the work you've done and certainly the reaction to it.
Well, the reactions have been all across the board. I'm telling you, you know. I mean, anytime you do something that is not the status quo, you know, you're going to have your share of detractors.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, for example, let's look at, throughout history, let's look at Christopher Columbus, mm-hmm. by the way, for whom I have no respect. But, you know, he said the world was round when everybody else said it was flat, and they called him a lunatic. You know, he's going to sail off the end of the earth and fall over and all that kind of thing. Well, of course, he proved them wrong. We look at Copernicus, the astronomer. You know, we earthlings are pretty egotistical, and we thought that everything revolved around us. And he said, no, the earth revolves around the sun. And they called him a heretic. They put him in jail. You know, 100 years later, Galileo said the same thing, and they called him a heretic. Well, guess what? The earth does revolve around the sun. The sun is the center of the universe, at least our universe. So, you know, when I told people I'm going to, you know, go look up some Klan people and sit down and talk with them and go to their rallies, you can imagine the reactions I got from both, you know, black and white people and anybody else I talked to. I mean, even friends. You know, close personal friends who thought highly of me. Some of them even shunned me, you know, 30 years ago. Like, oh, you know, Daryl's, you know, falling off his rocker or something. But now, you know, 30, 40 years later, they're calling me, Daryl, you know these people. What's going on with them? Tell me what's going on with them. I said, you know what? If you had listened to me 30 years ago, you'd know what's going on with them.
Mm-hmm. You have a moment that you talk about in the book. So you're born in Chicago. But
yeah.
Your dad was a diplomat, and so Correct. You grew up in all these, you know, foreign locales. And you have this moment in your childhood when you're 7 in Ethiopia. We're at a party at your house. It became very apparent that this white American diplomat did not want to shake the hands of any of the black people who were there. And I think you might have even caught him wiping his hand.
Yeah.
And that becomes a really important metaphor in this book.
Yes, indeed. Well, first of all, you know, I mean, I didn't think of him as white or black. You know, he was just, you know, somebody who worked at the embassy, you know, one of my dad's colleagues. And, we know diplomats have cocktail parties all the time because that's, you know, that's your job to foster better relations with foreign governments, with our own U.S. government. So you have all these foreign dignitaries over to your cocktail parties and you go to theirs, et cetera. So we had a party at our home. And I was just a little kid, like you said, 7 years old. and some of the American embassy people had come. And then this guy was new. He I guess, had just arrived in the country not too long ago. And he was there. And some Ethiopian dignitaries were there. And I was just, you know, sitting around like I normally do, just observing people. And I saw him shake hands with his colleagues and all that. And when an Ethiopian gentleman put his hand out to shake his hand, he was a little hesitant, but he shook the hand. And then he looked around, and when nobody was looking, except he didn't notice me because I'm just some little kid sitting in the corner, he took his hand and he like wiped it on the back of his pants. And I didn't think anything of it like in terms of black and white.
Yeah,
I just thought, you know, this is odd because we played that game in school as kids. We called it cooties. And we know when, you know, whenever a girl would touch us, or some girl would be touched by us, you know, they'd wipe their hands. Oh, you know, you got cooties, you know, or whatever. You know, it's a silly kid game. And I thought, you know, how strange this adult is playing cooties. Yeah. Now, in retrospect, you know, thinking about it, you know, later on in later years, I realized, oh man, you know, this guy, he was hesitant to shake the hand of a black person because he did it again, you know, with other people. I mean, I didn't watch him the whole night, but I saw him do it at least a couple more times. And in retrospect, the people that he did it with were some of the black dignitaries there.
And as you note throughout the book, like you meet all these Klan members, many of whom don't know you're a black man before they're meeting you.
Right.
But I can't think of a single instance in this book where they didn't shake your hand.
Yeah. I mean, now there were a few who refused to talk to me and,
sure,
you know, and some wanted to fight and all that kind of crazy stuff. But yeah, most of them, you know, after they got over the initial shock of, cause you know, they're expecting a white guy. Either they come to me or I go to them, you know?
So, before we jump in to the meat of the book, I do want to talk a bit about the music because
sure,
you and I are of a certain age where I feel very blessed because I saw Elvis perform. I saw Muddy Waters perform and you know, and people today, they don't have that experience. And I'm curious in terms of how much you think your musical education, because to me, there's a line that goes from your musical education to this work that you're doing, because music is that thing of like, there's no black and white. There's
that's
music
right
that you play. Yeah,
that's right. There's good and bad. That's all there is to it. You know, it's not a question of, you know, I don't want to play with you because you're black or you're Asian or Hispanic. It's like, can we sound good together? That's all it's about, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I mean, you know, people ask me, you know, how do I juxtapose my career in race reconciliation with my career in music? To me, they are synonymous. Mm-hmm. And let me explain my metaphor, if you will. When I'm playing with somebody else, I'm a side man. I do whatever their band leader needs me to do. In my band, or if somebody hires me to lead their band, I'm the band leader.
Yeah.
And my job is to foster harmony on my stage, mm-hmm, between all the voices, whether they're the vocal voices or the instrumental voices, piano, bass, drums, guitar, saxophone, you know, whatever's on stage. I want harmony. The only time I want dissonance is when I intentionally inject it into the music for effect, right? Because if dissonance happens randomly, you know, in a piece, that's not music. That's noise. Somebody hit a bad note, went out of tune, you know, whatever. So, you know, you want controlled dissonance for effect. So naturally, when I step off the stage and the gig is over and the curtain goes down and now I'm walking around in society, I want harmony around me. I don't want dissonance. Sure. Yeah. So I'm trying to foster harmony both on the stage in my professional life and off the stage in my social life. That's all. Simple as that.
Yeah. It's interesting, though. The one thing that you do, that improvisers do, which is they take the dissonance as an opportunity.
Right. Exactly.
You know, like, hey, maybe this is the opportunity of like this chord seems weird. Let's investigate this weird chord. And the entire book is so interesting that way because every one of these conversations, and some go better than others and all that,
sure,
but every one opens a door and you didn't. As a viewer or a reader, you don't expect it to go where it goes.
Right. It's an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know?
So, all right, let's talk about some of these folks. So explain for the audience who Roger Kelly was when you requested an interview with him, because this is a major figure both in the book, but in this Klan world.
Right. Okay, so when I met Roger Kelly, he was a Grand Dragon. Now, let me explain how the hierarchy of the Klan works so people understand. First of all, today there is no such thing, and hasn't been for a long time, there's no such thing as the Ku Klux Klan, yeah. All right? There used to be the Ku Klux Klan, one Ku Klux Klan, and chapters of that one Ku Klux Klan spread out all over the country. But over the decades, they have splintered off of each other. There's no longer Klan Central. So there are many, many different Klan groups. They all are autonomous, but they all use basically the same bylaws, the same colors on their robes, same secret handshake, passwords, titles, etc. But they are autonomous. Like, say, for example, you might have the Dixie Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Confederate Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. These are all separate KKK groups. If you see any of those groups together in public, they will hold a united front. But behind closed doors, they are rivals with each other. Okay, usually, you know, when you emanate hate, you also hate yourselves. They hate each other. Okay, they think each group thinks they're the real Klan, and that's a wannabe Klan because they all used to be part of the same Klan, but they splintered off because somebody embezzled money, somebody did something that shouldn't have done, you know, whatever. So anyway, if you have a Klan group in your state and you have a chapter of your particular Klan, and a state could have multiple Klan groups that are not related to each other, okay. If you have a chapter of your particular Klan group in another state or in multiple states, you may then consider yourself to be a national Klan group. So therefore, you must appoint a national leader who oversees all the states in which you have a chapter. Okay, so we call our national leader who oversees all our United States the president. In Klan terminology, that individual is known as the Imperial Wizard. Anybody that is prefixed with the term Imperial means that's a national officer. Wizard being the top. An imperial caliph is like a vice president, so like a vice wizard, all right? So then you have to have, and then you have secretary treasurer at that level, imperial so-and-so, imperial so-and-so. All right, so then below the imperial level is the state level. We call our state leader the governor. They call theirs the Grand Dragon. Mm-hmm. Anybody prefixed with the term grand is on the state level, dragon being the top. A grand caliph would be like a lieutenant governor. And then you have secretary, et cetera. Below the state level is the county level. And so each county in the state has a leader. And that person is prefixed with the word great. And he's known as the Great Titan. And they're also Klanswomen, but they don't have the higher titles. You know, they're very chauvinistic. So great is the county level. Within the county, you have districts. We call our district leaders, some states call them council members. Mm-hmm. And other states call them selectmen or aldermen, mayors, et cetera. That person is known as the Exalted Cyclops. And then below that is just regular, plain, white-robed Klansmen. And each level has colors that are associated with it. So Roger Kelly was the Grand Dragon of Maryland when I met him. Mm. And later on, throughout our relationship, he moved up to Imperial Wizard.
Mm. And is it safe to say you became friends?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And today I own his Klan robe and hood. And he, you know, through our friendship, through the conversations, you know, that we would have, which over time would cause a cognitive dissonance in his thinking, disrupt his thinking. And he shut down, his 13 chapters in 13 states.
Wow.
You know, when he left, he renounced it. And he did not just hand it over to the imperial caliph to, you carry on for me. No, he shut it down.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things, too, was he explained to you that he was a white separatist as opposed to a white supremacist.
Mm-hmm. And let me explain the difference in that.
Please.
Okay, so you have different levels of hate, if you will, or discrimination. A white separatist is someone who believes that, yes, different people can coexist, but separately. Blacks would have their own neighborhoods, Jews would have their own neighborhoods, school systems, swimming pools, restaurants, etc., and whites would have their own, and you don't crisscross. You don't, cross in somebody else's territory. You don't date, you don't intermarry and all that kind of thing. So total separate, separate but equal existence. A white supremacist is no. This is a white man's country. And non-whites need to go back to where they came from. So, and I run into both.
Yeah. Well, and the guy, so in the book, then you talk about, and I don't, his last name I might mispronounce, but Vernon Naymaster.
Naymaster, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, who was a Grand Dragon, and he was a white supremacist.
Yes.
So, but you were able to temper your, I mean, this is the thing, how much did, before you went into these conversations, how much did you have to sort of like zen yourself for like the you know, all right, I am not going to react in a certain way, or I know that this person, in the case of a white supremacist, this is someone who, you know, thinks very poorly of the outer you.
Yeah.
What did you have to prepare yourself differently, or was there always just like, I'm going to be Daryl, and Daryl's walking into this conversation?
You know, I didn't really even think about it, and I'll be honest with you. You know, I think really I'm the kind of person who, rather than get furious, I get curious, you know, what's up with this person? And I need to, you know, this man or this woman, I need to find out. But I think a lot, Kelly, that had to do with it was my upbringing. And I had a different upbringing than most Americans, black or white.
Yeah.
Most Americans do not travel. And according to our U.S. Census Bureau, less than 40% of Americans even own a passport, which means they've never been out of the country. All right. As a performer, I have played in all 50 states. Between traveling with my parents as a kid in the State Department, U.S. Embassy, Foreign Service, and now combining that with my adulthood travels as a performer or lecturer traveling around the world, I've been in 65 countries on 6 continents. So what does all that travel mean other than I have a lot of hotel points or frequent flyer miles, right? It means that I've been exposed to a wide, wide variety of people. And all of that has helped shape who I've become. And I can tell you that no matter how far I've gone from our country, whether it's right next door to Canada or right next door to Mexico or across the Atlantic, across the Pacific to the other side of the planet, everyone I meet, regardless of whether or not they look like me or speak my language or worship as I do, maybe they don't even worship at all, I've always concluded that every single person is a human being. And as such, every human being on this planet wants these 5 core values in their lives. Everyone wants to be loved. We all want to be respected. We all want to be heard. We want to be treated fairly and truthfully. And we all want the same things for our family as anybody else would want for their family. And if we can learn to apply those 5 core values or any of those 5 values, when we find ourselves in an adversarial situation or in a culture or society in which we're unfamiliar or uncomfortable, I can guarantee you that your navigation of that situation, that culture, that society will be much more smooth, much more positive, and much more productive. You know, my favorite quote of all time is by Mark Twain. You know, his real name was Samuel Clemens, right? He had a lot of great quotes, but my favorite one is called the travel quote. And Mark Twain said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." And that is so true. Now, all that travel does not make me a better human being than someone with less travel. But what it does is it gives me a better and more broad perspective on humanity than most people who have not had that kind of exposure. All they can do is presume what somebody is like, where I can tell them what somebody is like because I know them. I've lived with them. I've gone to school with them. I've worked with them. I've socialized with them. So I have a more comprehensive perspective, right, than just presuming what somebody is like based upon the color of their skin or their religion or whatever else. So having had that experience, and seeing people who look like people who hate me, I realized, who's treated me very well, I can't just paint everybody with a broad brush, you know? So it's like, if you, again, since you use the word metaphor or analogy, if your first experience was with a dog, and let's say the dog was a Chihuahua, and you were a little kid, and the Chihuahua just, you know, bit the daylights out of you, you might have, if depending upon how severe the attack was, you might have a fear of all dogs, but you would certainly have some trepidation about Chihuahuas. Okay. But if you had played with Chihuahuas, you know, numerous times in the past, and they all loved you and licked you and so forth and so on, and then, you know, you go to some new friend's house and his or her Chihuahua bites you, you're not going to judge all Chihuahuas by that incident, right? But now some people, you know, if I tell you, if Kelly, you know, you're coming over to my house for the first time, just come down this street, turn that way. On the second driveway on the right, you'll see a chain link fence around my yard. You'll probably see my little lap poodle running around the yard. Just come on up to me and ring the doorbell. You're not going to think twice. Mm-hmm. But maybe if I said, okay, you know, you'll see my pit bull in the yard. Just come on up and ring the doorbell. You might, you know, is your pit bull cool? Because, yeah. You know, pit bulls carry a reputation. And you can't paint all pit bulls as being mean. So I had an experience of being exposed to people who looked like the people who would throw rocks and bottles at me, you know, when I was a kid marching in the Cub Scouts as the only black scout. But these people treated me very well. Now, if my first experience in dealing with white people was having rocks and bottles thrown at me, maybe I wouldn't be doing this work today.
It's interesting. I don't really plan out when the podcasts get taped or how they flow. It's sort of everyone's schedule, and I had a surgery, so the like stuff got delayed. The other podcast I'm taping this week is with a British scientist, Faye Bound Alberti, who has a book called it's called The Face. It's the cultural history of faces. And what she points out is, for the bulk of humanity, no one was paying attention to this. We didn't have mirrors. No one's taking selfies. So right. This idea, which really was in Victorian times, that the face might reveal something inner is relatively new. And so, as I'm reading her book, I'm like, oh, this is so tied to Daryl's work, because at its root, what she's saying is like, this is not inside, like it was not inside of us that we were judging people in these ways. That stuff all came later. And I know this too. I was talking about my son moved to Atlanta. And I live in Chicago. Chicago is a very segregated city even today.
I was born in Chicago.
Yeah, right. Black people and white people, if they're in the same building, it's the black people who are playing for the Bulls and the mostly white people who are watching. In Atlanta, my son, who's an actor, I have never been in as diverse an audience. And it's just a different sort of cultural experience down there. So even in 2026 in major urban areas that we think of as being enlightened or not, this kind of stuff is still going on, like, seriously. And I think that's why, I mean, in many ways, that's why you're still having these conversations, because it ain't over.
Yeah. 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 And that's why I continue to do the work I do.
So I want to talk about, you have a section called Guidelines for Cross-Color Communication. And one of the things that we've done at Second City in the last probably like 15 years is a lot of work using so in improv, right? And you know this from your experience musically, it's the same theatrically, right? You have to listen to the other person. You have to build upon what they say. Everything they mm-hmm. do is right. You have to assume that so that you're going back and forth. And the idea that all of us are better than one of us, all these really lovely ideas about how harmony works. Mm-hmm. Are things that we then work with behavioral scientists and take into companies to get people to make better teams, but also to treat each other more effectively. We work with the police to try mm-hmm. to get them to listen and tell better stories. So you have these guidelines for cross-color communication, but number one, which I think is important and relates to the very first thing that we talked about, which is keep in mind that ignorance breeds fear, which to me is sort of saying, remember that that's always going to be a part of you in some regard. You're going to have some potentially irrational fear and an irrational mm-hmm. fear mm-hmm. Of whatever. And if you know that going in, I think you can lean into your curiosity as opposed to your blame or fear, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the followed quickly by keep your fear in check, keep your hatred in check. So that seems like a lot of pre-work that you're asking rightly for people to do when they're going into these conversations.
Well, you know, always, you know, do your homework.
Yeah.
Number one, know who you are. Know who you are, because if you don't know who you are and you go into a situation, you know, whether it's about race, whether it's about abortion, whether it's about any controversial topic, you're on one side, they're on the other side, right?
Yeah.
Know your position, know who you are, because if you don't do that and you go in, they're going to tell you who you are. And if you don't know who you are, you might, you know, walk out believing them, you know. But when you know who you are and you go in, you know, do have an open mind. Be willing to listen objectively and, you know, consider their point of view. If something, you know, resonates as, you know, that needs to be, you know, maybe I need to look at that a little differently or see it from that perspective. You know, you may change your mind on certain things or at least understand why they believe it, you know, because maybe they haven't had the same experience that you've had, you know. So, you know, understand that. But always know who you are and have, you know, and be open to listening to what they have to say and consider what they have to say. That's number one. But also know who they are and learn as much as you can about them. Because I found this out. Even though somebody may hate you, maybe they don't like you, maybe it's even to the point of hating you for whatever reason, the color of your skin or the fact that you wear glasses, you know, whatever the case may be, right? If they realize that you've done your homework and you know something about them, they're impressed. Yeah. And they will respect you.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't have to like you to respect you. So I know a lot about white supremacy. I know a lot about the Klan. I know the history, you know, and I can sit there and recite it more times better than they can.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, whoa, you know, while they may not like me, they respect me. And that, you know, helps the conversation to become more cohesive and draw them in.
Well, it's interesting. So we're going to ask you at the end of our conversation for a yes and story. When we have a guest back, the thing that we ask them for is a thank you because story, which also comes from the work that we've done with behavioral scientists. And the idea there is when you're trying to stay inside a difficult conversation, the best way to do it is basically, first of all, thanking someone for them sharing their opinion, even if you don't agree with it, because it sets off the gratitude part of the brain. And then the because is you have to find something that you value in what they said. I don't care how tiny, because that changes the equation of the room. And when you're when you lay out these conversations you had with all these different Klan people, the minute you get them talking and talking about their past and asking them more questions, they become more generous with their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
They might even admit to a doubt. They might admit to something else. And that is very consistent in this. And it's not like, I mean, Roger became someone who obviously said, hey, but you have other people here who probably didn't change and kept their values. But at least you seem to have moved them.
Well, you know, and another thing, speaking of, you know, how you have these conversations, I mean, everybody's heard of us versus them.
Yeah.
So we all know what that is. You know, it separates people. Well, in that regard, we also need, so we don't talk about us and them. We also need to eliminate, when we're having a conversation with someone with whom we're having a disagreement, again, it doesn't necessarily have to be about race. It could be about any other hot topic. Let's eliminate the words I, me, and you, because I, me, and you are just the singular forms of us and them, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking with you and you know, we're disagreeing on whatever it is, rather than say, you know, well, you, Kelly, you believe this and well, I think it's like this, you know, I'm separating us. So why don't I say, hey, Kelly, you know, let us look at it like this for a second. Or can we look at it like this?
Mm.
Or let's look at it, let us look at it from this perspective. You know, that way I'm putting us on the same page, on the same side of the fence, rather than separating you and me.
So I'm curious.
And that also works.
Yeah. And I'm curious because let's say you and I were having this we started this podcast 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You and I had talked 10 years ago with this. What I know is my core audience would get this and be on it. And you know, let's just be honest. This is a lefty, you know, theater podcast, you know, all that. Something has changed in the last few years where there is I can no longer assume that people who might qualify as liberal or on the left are actually going to agree with the idea that we should reach out to people who think differently than us. And
sure.
I wonder, how has that changed for you in terms of either the conversations you've had or the way you approach them, or does it not? Are you just doing your thing? And figure times have changed?
Well, times have changed, and we are in a culture now. To be honest, it reflects upon, who's leading the country.
Yeah.
And the leadership. And there's a lot of cancel culture. It's either this way or my way or the highway, mentality. And so, we see people who engage in that, there is no gray area. It's either black or white. And we see people like that rise to the top. Then we want to rise to the top. So then that sets the template. Well, if that guy or girl or whoever, was that boisterous or whatever, and became the top person in the country, well, then at my little level, I can become the top person in my neighborhood or my county or my state by following that template. So we're seeing a lot of that, sort of like, a major pop star, wears one silver glove, then all the kids who like him wear one silver glove,
Right.
Or turn their collar up like Elvis, whatever the case is. We are basically followers in this country. And we look to our leaders to guide us, whether it's in politics, whether it's in entertainment, in whatever. We're looking to be led to a higher ground. And we admire people who go to that ground. And sometimes, unfortunately, when they rise to those things with lack of ethics or morals, we have to weigh ourselves and say, well, do I want that position more than I want morality or ethical things? We have to weigh that, and some people choose not so wisely.
I'm wondering too, from your experience and the life you've lived, do you see this as just let me admit this, the way I see it, which is like, hey, it goes up and it goes down. Like you're going to have these waves where things get real bad. And what we've been lucky is that a lot of times that's followed by some really good, but it's, this is the journey we're on. And right now might be a kind of a dark time, but that doesn't mean that it's going to always go that way.
Yes, things are always going to go up and down, but nothing goes up and down just by happenstance.
No.
Unless it's, a force of nature, like a Hurricane Katrina, things, that we don't control. But other things are man-made. And, we are always evolving. And let me tell you what's going on here, Kelly, in our country. All right. A lot of, the media knows about this, but they don't talk about it so much. But they do know. I learned this back in 1982. But before 1982, let's go back to 1974. I was age 15 in the 10th grade. And we had a class called the POTC, which stood for Problems of the 20th Century. Had a phenomenal teacher. He would bring in various controversial type speakers to talk on different topics, like, say, abortion or whatever. And one day he to our class, one day he brought in the head of the American Nazi Party. Now, you could never get away with that today.
Okay? You couldn't.
And see, I wish we could. Yeah. I do. I hate political correctness. Let everybody talk so we can see what it's all about. But anyway, back then you could do that. So now, to give you a little background, the American Nazi Party was founded in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac River from D.C., by a fellow named George Lincoln Rockwell, who was a U.S. Marine, former U.S. Marine, and he was a big proponent of the ideology of Hitler. And every time Martin Luther King would have his marches, Rockwell and his stormtroopers would confront King. Well, Rockwell was murdered by one of his own Nazis right there in Arlington, Virginia. They got into an argument, and John Poulter shot and killed Rockwell. So Rockwell's right-hand guy was a guy named Matt Cole. And on this day in 1974, Matt Cole came to my high school with his right-hand guy, Martin Kerr. So they were now leading the American Nazi Party, and they addressed my class. And they're standing at the front of the classroom espousing the views of white supremacy. Matt Cole pointed at me and pointed at another black kid in the class and said, "We're going to ship you back to Africa." And then he went like this, "And all you Jews out there, you're going back to Israel." And I just sat, I'm 15. I'm just sitting there, like, I look at this guy. What is this man talking about? Right. And one of my classmates, you know, piped up. I didn't say anything. You know, I'm just looking at the guy. And one of my classmates, she piped up and said, well, they live here. Well, you know, what if they don't want to go? And Mackle said, oh, they have no choice. If they do not leave voluntarily, they will be exterminated in the upcoming race war. That was the first time I heard the term race war. Mm-hmm. I heard a lot of other things about, you know, race war. What is this guy talking about? And so I want to skip ahead. So, you know, that fascinated me. And that propelled me into getting more and more information on this stuff. And so 8 years later, I'm now 2 years graduated from college. And I you know, music was my profession, but studying race relations was my obsession. So, so I sought out Matt Cole. I found him and I had a conversation with him. He remembered me from 8 years prior.
Wow.
Yeah. And we had a good conversation. He told me a lot of lies, but one thing he told me was true. And this is 1982. And he told me that they, meaning they, the white supremacy movement, were very concerned about the year 2042. Mm-hmm. And he told me that, you know, if you watch the census, the demographics are shifting. And if things do not stop, the trend that they're heading at, in 2042, this country will be 50-50. 50% white, 50% non-white. Between 2045 and 2050, it's going to flip. Yes. And whites, for the first time, will become the minority in this country. They're very concerned about that. And so I've been watching that. And he was right about that. He was absolutely 100% right. And so this is why we're seeing an uptick in lone wolves, and an uptick in all these groups. I've been doing this now for 46 years. Mm-hmm. When I first started, there was the KKK, neo-Nazis, and white power skinheads. Now you got the KKK, the neo-Nazis, white power skinheads, the alt-right, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, on and on and on and on. And they're all saying, come join us, we're going to take back our country. Well, people out of fear of their identity being erased, because I talk to these people, and they're like, Daryl, I don't want my grandkids to be brown. You know, they call it the browning of America, mm-hmm. or white genocide through miscegenation, right? So people out of fear run and join these groups to take our country back. Well, when the group fails to take our country back in a timely manner, some of them get antsy and say, you know what? If the Klan can't do it or the Nazis can't do it, I'll do it myself. And they walk into a black church, boom, 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 or Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Yeah. You know, Walmart in El Paso, Buffalo Grocery Store, the Sikh Indian Temple, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. You know, these are called lone wolves. They're acting on their own. And I know some of these people. And some of the, you know, they truly believe that they are patriots. They are saving our country. Their mentality is, we discovered this country. We built this country. We wrote the Constitution. And people are coming here who don't look like us and taking our country away from us. And they're surrounded by that echo chamber. You know, and it just grows. So they're seeing this happen, and it's their job to make sure it stops and they maintain, you know, supremacy or majority.
So what's fascinating about this part of the conversation for me, is I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, and you're kind of giving me one right now, which is you take a fair amount of heat for being a guy who is willing to go have these conversations. You are also sounding the alarm that, you know, that there is a real concern here that these people who otherize others, who might be promoting a race war, that's a real problem that exists that a lot of other people aren't talking about.
Have you considered why Canada was asked to be the 51st state?
Tell me.
Well,
yeah, a lot of white. Fascinating. Yeah, they're not doing that down south.
Exactly. Why? You know, why not ask Mexico? You know, you want to control the drugs coming across the border and the rapists and the murderers that you see are coming across the border? Make them a state, and then you can control them.
Is your answer to this fight, let's call it this answer to this fight, still love, still acceptance, still trying to see people? Is that how we
absolutely
do this?
I still do it. Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
We, you know, education and exposure is the key. Listen, we have the technology to put, well, first of all, we call ourselves the greatest country on the face of this earth. You know, I mean, I'm loyal. I'm a patriot. I love my country. But I can admit that we have a lot of flaws.
Sure.
Those flaws have to be fixed. Okay. So I have a problem with that statement. But I'll go so far as to say that perhaps we are the greatest country on the face of this earth technologically. Mm-hmm. After all, we built the technology. We Americans built the technology to put a man on the moon. Mm-hmm. And we also built the technology to talk to that man while he was walking around on the moon. Talking about Neil Armstrong.
Yep.
So while he was walking around on the surface of the moon, we built the technology to speak to him live via satellite radio phone when he was talking about one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind. We built the technology that everybody in the world pretty much has today, email and texting, you know, cell phones. We can talk to anybody on this planet by typing a few words, hitting a few numbers, hit send, and we're, you know, across the ocean, wherever. How is it that we, as Americans, can speak to people as far away as the moon or anywhere on this planet, but so many of us have difficulty talking to the person right next door because he or she is a different skin color, a different religion, a different persuasion, a different whatever? So it seems to me that before we can call ourselves the greatest, perhaps our ideology needs to catch up to our technology. And once we get them both up there, then we can truly brag. Because after all, we're living in the 21st century. We're living in space age times. We need to stop thinking with Stone Age minds.
Love it. All right. So our final question, we always ask our guests for a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, when two people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And actually don't get that far by saying yes. So we talk about yes anding, about affirming and contributing and building and heightening. So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story from your life, even though your life is one giant yes and story.
Yeah. I mean, there've been a lot of, you know, bizarre, wild, unimaginable things, but they were true. But I'll give you one. So this white supremacist, he got in some trouble and, you know, had to spend a little bit of time in prison. And I befriended him. I did not agree with his ideology. It's one thing to you don't have to respect what somebody believes or says, but respect their right to voice their opinion. Uh-huh. Because, you know, if you want them to hear your opinion, you have to be willing to sit down and listen to theirs, regardless of how heinous or ridiculous it may be. So, you know, he was a vehemently racist, anti-Semite, et cetera. And I befriended him. You know, we'd have conversations. And he went to prison for firing a gun in the direction of a black person. And so I worked with them, had conversations, spent a lot of time, and I continue to. And he invited me, number one, to his wedding. To a Klan wedding. So I'm the only black guy at a Klan wedding, right? And this was all documented, you know, by a major, you know, news network. And before that, you know, I said yes, I would go to the wedding. I've been working with them, and if he you know, wants me to be a part of his special day, why not? You know,
I'm not gonna
say no because he's in the Klan. I mean, you know, he wants me to be there. So then turns out the young lady's father was ill and could not, escort his daughter down the aisle and give her away. Rather than ask one of their trusted Klansmen to step in as a surrogate father, they asked me. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, I had to pause for a second, like, whoa,
sure.
You know, I got to think about this. You know, do I want to do this? You know what? If they want me to be part of that special day in that regard, yes, I will do it. It's never been done before in history. Mm-hmm. I will do it. And I said, but listen, I want to document that. All right. Yeah. So I called the major news source and said, hey, do you all want to go to this wedding? They said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they showed it on TV all over the world. You know, and of course, he got a bunch of hate mail from Klan people all over, you know, how can you let that, you know, N-word, you know, march your bride down the aisle and give her a kiss and so forth and so on. That made him reflect back the same thing he was doing before. So now, you know, he's seen the mirror and seeing how ridiculous it is. So see, sometimes, you know, we look for rationale in everybody. And see, it's like, you know, well, that doesn't even make sense. Why would a Klansman let a black man walk his, well, first of all, why would he invite a black man to his wedding? Yeah. Why would he let a black man walk his bride down the aisle? That's because you're thinking rationally. You're thinking logically. All right. Well, what you have to understand is this. To be a racist, to judge somebody simply on the color of their skin, is not rational.
No.
So somebody who does that is apt to do more irrational things, like invite a black guy to the wedding or have him walk her down the aisle. So you're dealing with irrationality. So you have to look at it like that. All right? Because if you're looking for rationale, you're not going to find it. Because if you can rationalize that, you can rationalize him hating black people or Jewish people. So you have to look at it as irrational. All right? And racism is irrational. So in doing so, it brought us together. All right? Mm-hmm. I went to church with him about a month ago. And he wanted to sing a hymn, you know, from the pulpit. I accompanied him on the piano.
Yeah, that's, I mean, what a lovely place for us to end, because, you know, we know this from behavioral science and economics and all that, that for years we've thought that people behave rationally. They don't. So this idea of, I've never thought about applying it to this kind of, you know, race reconciliation, you know, and that sort of thing. But of course that's the case. Daryl Davis has a couple of books. The one that I read, The Klan Whisperer, is available on Amazon. Daryl, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Getting DSand is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.